This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to bbc.co.uk/radio3.
Theatre directors can be divided into those who have acted and those who have not. I have no opinion about whether either is better or worse, but I do think it true that for those of us who have acted, we will never forget the fear, the excitement, and the frustration of performing. I acted for a decade before I began to direct, a decade of fun, disappointment, and exhilaration, but most importantly, a decade of getting to know the rhythm, needs, and demands of an audience. I wasn't a particularly successful actor by traditional standards. I spent many years touring around Devon primary schools, telling stories to 5 to 11-year-olds. This was light years away from my early dream of playing Juliet at the RSC. But I found in those chilly school halls and smelly gymnasiums a freedom, simplicity, and sheer delight that has guided my work ever since. The 5 a.m. starts were torturous, but it was looking into those faces, clear of expectation and judgment, that began to shape the director I am today. I try to coax my audience into a simpler state and tempt them to respond to work in a childlike way. To do this, I carefully craft the experience to remind them of an earlier, easier, more instinctive time in their lives. I try to remember not only what it was like to perform to children, but also to remember what it was like to be a child. And it is this remembrance that also governs how I work with actors and create the environment of the rehearsal room. Everything starts with why. The why I am referring to is the most fundamental question when creating work. Why do we want to tell this story? As servants to the story, it is our duty to ask this question. Without a truthful answer, we will flounder and lose our way. For example, when choosing to produce The Red Shoes, I realised that it was my own divorce and need for freedom that I was exploring. When moved to tackle Brief Encounter, I knew I was revealing the pain of infidelity, of choice, and questioning our received moral code. With Don John, it was a more conscious desire to tell the tale of this womaniser from the women's perspective, to look at the debris in the famous Lothario's wake. These are some of the whys. We ask this question in the first days of rehearsal. I ask the actors to own the material, to make a link to their own lives and experiences. The why of it will get them through the longest, toughest of tours. We tell stories because they matter, because they reach out to the child in us all, because they remind us that we are in it together and witnessing it together, rather like we were in that school hall. We spend several days on these story foundations, lingering on the narrative and its impact on us as individuals and as a team. By team, I mean the whole crew that will eventually make the work come to life. Actors, musicians, designers, lighting, sound and stage management all gather to start the adventure, to feel the tickle of what is to come. All are equal voices in the room. Any one of us may hold a key, an idea or a link that helps to reveal the deeper meaning of the material. My job is to ask the right questions and listen carefully to the answers, spoken and unspoken. We do not read the text. We tell the story. We break it down into themes and structures. We draw pictures of the story and create installations to reveal the inner lives of the characters. We sing songs, learn musical instruments, and attempt to dance. We cover the walls with our findings and scribblings, knowing that in these early discussions the vital clues will lurk. In these tasks, by telling the story between ourselves, we will begin to find what matters. Certain themes will bob to the surface, whilst others are forgotten. This is narrative evolution. I have been accused of taking too many liberties. For example, my production of Cymbeline, which I thought I stylishly wrenched into the 21st century. I added a character called Joan, a reference to the brilliantly life-loving Joan Collins, and had her played by the same male actor who played Cymbeline. And why not? Shakespeare is long dead, and the world he wrote for long gone. Don't think that this is my being disrespectful. I believe it is the exact opposite. He was the master storyteller, the pole star. He took stories from the Greeks, from history and from folklore and made them his own. He used these well-known structures to hang his feelings, questions, ideas and insights onto, like a beautiful bespoke hat stand. These stories became the anchor for Shakespeare's genius, for his whys. After these foundations, we start work on the superstructure. We learn the rhythm of the whole, the arc of the story, and where we are all heading. This part of the process is the map. If, as a company, we understand the structure, it is easy to adjust later on. I can say at a later date, move through that section quicker, or cut that scene, we all need to get to the next event. Traditional actors may be offended by such bluntness, mourn such losses, but my story servants will understand what I am saying and why. The story is the thing. So, now we have the foundations and the map, we are heading for the fun part. As we venture further from home, we can enjoy the instability of character and comedy. I remember keenly the fear of being a performer, the pressure to be brilliant, to impress, to earn your place. I try to actively remove these useless fears. I use lights, costumes, music and sound to create a sensuous world. I suggest a ridiculous hat or strange shoes, something to throw a cheeky clue that misbehaviour is not only allowed, but essential. In their makeshift costumes and in the comfort of soft lighting and music, we explore the characters. Using few, if any, words at this stage, I play with these newborn creatures, suggesting that they dance or sing for us, that they dress up or hide. There is no picking through text, analysing what is said, no slow, fearful build-up to putting it on its feet. No, these characters are born almost fully formed, with deep inner lives and rhythms. The actors, my heroes, as they fearlessly give themselves to the process, improvise with a breathtaking freedom, as they allow the story, meaning, world and character to interact. These days, when we meet the characters, are exhilarating and thrilling. It's the moment when Geppetto realises that Pinocchio lives, when we allow the story to take on a life of its own. There is a crucial intellectual shift when thinking of oneself as a storyteller rather than a director. I live, breathe, and own each beat of the piece, drawing no distinction between my storytelling tools. Performance, lighting, design, music, sound, dance, film, puppetry, all are at my disposal when serving the tale. The same goes for the performers. A traditional actor is one who absorbs him or herself into another's psyche, until they are, to all intents and purposes, a different person. A storyteller, however, is charged with the communication of a story, of an emotion or a lesson. This is a subtle but profound shift. As a classically trained actress, I found this storytelling state incredibly hard. I found simply being myself exposing and unnerving. I wanted the comfort of someone else's skin, someone else's voice. I wanted to get lost in the dark and enjoy a comforting fantasy. Imagine the crash when I landed in those school halls at 9 a.m. No lights, nothing to hide behind. No, there is just you, the audience, and the story. I had to learn to talk with the children as they came in, to slide gently between ordinary speaking to performance, to surprise them when the emotion washed over the tales we told, and to make them gasp as we teased the denouement out to its resolution. This ease of performance was a hard-fought-for freedom. I remember tears and rages of frustration. But, like riding a bike, these techniques are ones that you can never forget. No matter how sophisticated the work I produce becomes, I always ask that my actors inhabit the same space, the same world, the same temperature and situation that the audience do. I ask that they look them in the eye, acknowledge when a prop falls apart or a foam goes off, and treat them with the generosity of a friend confiding in trustful intimacy. This is a tough ask. I have often asked my cast to strip down to only their underwear, to expose their imperfect flesh. But this is only an extension of how I am asking them to perform, simple, unpackaged, and wanting only to tell the story. If something isn't working, the criticism is not of the actor, but of the choice. This is understood in the room. We are a team of detectives, the famous Five or Secret Seven, exploring untold truths and uncovering human mysteries and marvels. If the mystery is not revealed, then we are looking in the wrong place. Move on. My team is robust and joyful. They accept cuts with humour and understanding. They know that the story, not the play, is the thing. So, can these principles and aesthetics of storytelling really impact on shows as diverse as Brief Encounter, Tristan and Isolde, and The Bacchae? The answer is yes. That by always treating the source as a story, not as a text, the landscape of choices gently alter. For example, by viewing Brief Encounter as a story, I was able to see and reveal the folktale structure of a silky story. These ancient tales, passed down orally from generation to generation, are stories of seal women, who, when taken from their natural environment, wither and wane. They are ultimately forced to leave their partners and children to return to their true place and find deep freedoms. Using storytelling techniques that trample on the principles of Stanislavski and the Fourth Wall, I was able to introduce the call of the sea, the longing for freedom, and a physicality that, although completely unlike the reality of being a woman in the 1930s, told the story of being in love, of craving total immersion, and the heart-stopping fear of diving into the deep. This storytelling approach, when applied to this most adult, intellectual and crafted of texts, made grown men and women cry. It made them sidestep their logic and experience the deeper meaning, the body of the iceberg, their own despair. I suppose I am back to the why. Why do I need to tell this story to these people? In those school hall days, I always tried to hold firm to that simple question. Because I want to make the children laugh. Because I want them to know that when they are in the dark, they are not alone. Because I want to give them the gift of a lifetime of comfort that a well-told, meaningful story can give. Nothing changes when making work now. I know why, I know who for, I know the story, and I know the characters. Now, if I have laid the right foundations and planted the right seeds, now the story will begin to take on a power and force of its own. All that remains is for me to hold on tight, hold my nerve, and steer the story to the conclusion it will ask for. I just have to keep looking for clues, keep searching for surprise, and the serendipitous accident that will surely happen now we are in the right waters. As custodian of the story, I now stand in a long, lovely, profound chain that links the story to the actors, to the characters, to the audience, to the times we live in themselves. Now, like the children in those Devon primary schools, my team of story servants and I have open faces. We are clear of cynicism, fear, judgment, or pretense. We know our task. We love it, and we accept it with joy and passion. My, we are the lucky ones.